Welcome back to another episode of The Image Doctors. It's July 6, 2006. I'm Jason O'Dell.
I'm Rick Walker.
Thanks for joining us again today. We've got a great show planned for you. Before we get started, I want to mention that today's show is brought to you by Bibble Pro. Bibble Pro software for RAW conversion is currently running version 4.8. You can download a trial copy at www.bibblelabs.com. Thanks to Bibble for sponsoring this episode of The Image Doctors. Mm-hmm. So let's get started. We have some listener mail to some questions to answer today. And today's question comes from Robert Wood.
Robert asks a question about getting a film body. He's been using a D70 for a little while and is interested in shooting some film in addition to the digital stuff, which I think is very cool. That's something I definitely would like to encourage because I think there's some good attributes with film. And he's just curious about which body to get. He had
what's a good value?
Yeah, what's a good value? He'd been using an N70 in the past, and he's viewing this as an opportunity to get the Nikon body that he always wanted but never could afford. And boy, is it a good time to get a used film body. The price range has really compressed down. Just a few years ago, F5s were selling new for about $2,200, $2,300, mm-hmm. and F100, those started out around $1,300 street price, and the prices have just plummeted. You can get a really nice F5 off of eBay for around $700.
Yeah, or even less if you get lucky.
Yeah, yeah. And, F4's quite a bit less than that, F100's less than that, so you're talking very little for an extremely high-quality body. So which one do you get? Well, a few things to think about. If you're looking for an autofocus camera, then probably the main ones to consider, my opinion, would be something like an F5, an F4, or an F100. And it just depends on what your needs are. The F100 and the F5 are going to have the best autofocus performance.
Right.
They're both built very well. The F5 is practically indestructible. And you're not talking a whole lot of difference in price, just a few hundred dollars at the most.
Yeah, the form factor is one of the biggest mm-hmm. differences between those two cameras. Do you want one that, the F100 and the F4 had the optional battery grip, to make it larger. The F5, that's integrated into it, so that's something to keep in mind. If you like the big camera, there's no better deal right now than getting the F5.
Yeah. And we've both owned them. I still have mine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an excellent camera. And you do have the option of the interchangeable prisms on it, which is kind of cool if you ever want to do close-up work or things like that, whereas the F100 doesn't have that. But for travel photography, when you want something a little bit smaller, it's hard to beat the F100.
Oh, it was a good camera then.
Yeah,
it hasn't changed, and to be able to pick one of these things up for probably less than $500 is incredible.
Yeah,
that's what an N90, that's what an N70 or an N80 would have cost.
I can remember when an N90S was about $1,000.
So, that's an amazing deal.
You're getting an awful lot of value with it. Now the F4. And it comes in a couple different flavors, the plain old F4, the F4S, which has the vertical grip on it, and the F4E, which also has a vertical grip on it. It's a little bit larger and will take rechargeable batteries. It has the more traditional controls, so you still have a shutter speed dial. You still adjust the aperture via the aperture ring on the lens.
Right.
Its autofocus isn't as good as the others. It works, and if you're not doing a lot of really high-speed action photography, it works fine. It just doesn't have anything more than a central sensor, and the autofocus motor is a little bit slow. But
if you have a lot of manual focus lenses,
it's
dream.
It's a great body because it's built like a tank, and if you are using the manual focus lenses, you don't care about the sub-command dial thing. That you want to use the aperture ring anyway, and I used it for a long time as a landscape camera. It seems a little bit weird. It's got the built-in motor drive and stuff, which you think wouldn't matter a whole lot, but it's actually kind of handy, especially if you're bracketing images. Mm-hmm. And it has a built-in spot meter, which is also very nice when you're doing that.
And let's face
it,
it's a Nikon F. It's an F camera.
Mm-hmm.
They never made a bad one.
Oh, no.
So,
I've still got my F4, too, yeah. and it's... it's quite nice, and you can strip it down to a smaller size, but not using the larger battery packs. You can get a thing called an MB20. And then it makes it a fairly compact camera. It's not tiny by any means, but it reduces the height quite a bit, and it really does have a nice solid feel to it. So, you know, those are some of the options out there. Nikon's got a lot of other great film cameras too, but I think with the prices having dropped so much, you know, why not go for one of their truly great right. cameras? The other ones to look at if you want a manual focus camera, the F3, same thing, you know, bulletproof, very reliable, very cheap at the moment, and the FM2, FE2 series as well. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of good ones.
Obviously, the new market is anchored by the F6, which is still going to cost you about $1,600 or $1,700.
Yeah, so it's a wonderful camera, but you know, since it's still available new, the prices are quite a bit higher. So if you're looking for, you know, probably the best bang for the buck, so to speak, it's probably one of the ones that we just mentioned.
Now, this question sort of leads us into our next topic, which is what to look for when you're buying used equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a lot of used equipment on the market right now, there's just a flood of people dumping their film cameras to move to digital.
It's the old supply and demand thing, and the supply is very high.
There's no better time than to be looking for a good deal on a used lens, but we want to talk for a few minutes about what you should be looking for, where to look for, you know, where should you go to buy a used lens, what is a good price, what can you do, because it can be an intimidating experience if you're not buying something used physically at a camera shop where you can try it out. I mean, that would be your first place to go. Go to your local camera shop. They might have a lot of used lenses.
But you know, a lot of them don't anymore.
Right.
Yeah, eBay has just changed things dramatically. And a lot of local camera shops have virtually stopped selling
used equipment. Or they're selling their used equipment on eBay.
Yeah, so. Yeah, it's true. So online is become the more common way of getting something, and it does have some issues in that you can't handle it. You can't see every aspect of it. You can't try out the lens and make sure things are working correctly. But some of the things that you can do, and by the way, we'll put in a plug for our own for sale forum because it's got an extremely good track record.
Yeah.
You know, I get to see, you know, whether or not we have issues with sellers, and I can tell you, I just really can't even recall any.
There's a certain community spirit, I think, that lenses people tend to make they want to preserve their reputation.
Yeah.
And the same can be said about something like eBay, too, but you just have to be a little bit more careful.
You have to be more careful. The virtue with eBay is there's a much larger selection. You know, you can pretty much find anything you want, given a little bit of time and patience, and not even that much. So some of the things to consider, you know, when someone is selling something, are there photos available? How many of them are there? How detailed are they? Are they in focus or out of focus? I think when you have very few photos and they're out of focus, worry a little bit that might be deliberate and disguising some damage or problems to it.
Look for the feedback of the seller.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, if they have a great rating and a lot of positive feedback, you're probably going to be in good shape.
Yeah.
That's the strength of eBay.
Right. When they have very few feedback comments, just a couple, you know, it could be a great person that's just starting out, or it could be someone that had a lot of issues and went out and got a brand new user ID to start over again. So it can be a little bit of a worry. Your risk level goes up when someone doesn't have a lot of feedback comments. The you know, so we talked about photos and stuff. Look at the description of the item too. When it has virtually nothing about the specific lens or camera or whatever, and it's just a general comment that's been copied and pasted out of some other source, there's a chance that they may be kind of hiding some information about the exact thing.
Try to buy from the person who actually owns the lens or the camera. There's a lot of third-party resellers out there who will provide a service to a potential seller and say, oh, I'll set this up on eBay for you. Not that that's bad, but if you ask a question, a lot of times you won't get the feedback directly from the person who owns the product. They say, well, I have to ask so-and-so, and I'm not really sure because I'm not the one who's selling. You know, this isn't my product.
Worry, too, about the ads placed by an individual where it says, hey, I'm selling it for someone else, and I don't know anything about this thing. That can be accurate. It can also be a bit of a ruse to hide the fact that this item doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll just disavow all knowledge of it. So, you know, that's something you should consider. Think about sending comments to someone.
Right. Most importantly, I mean, there is a function on eBay where you can ask the seller a question. And if you don't get the kind of response that you feel is appropriate, then don't bid on the item.
Yeah. And some fair things, you know, ask about the diaphragm. Is it working correctly? Is it sluggish? Are the lens surfaces clean and scratch free? What about areas of the body or the lens or whatever that you can't see in the photos? What's the condition of those? Will they allow you to return it after, you know, let's say 3 or 4 days, if for some reason it doesn't align with the written material or if it's not working? Those are all fair things to do, and then you can take that data and use it however you want. You want to take the risk or not.
Mm-hmm.
So those are just some things to consider. Also, there are a couple articles that actually I wrote on the site that are in the Nikkor's forum that discuss, you know, great values in used lenses, especially if you're looking for manual focus lenses, although it does include a lot of autofocus ones.
Or if you're looking for deals for a lens for your film camera,
mm-hmm.
It's a really good
There's some that just aren't that popular on digital bodies,
right,
for
like
a lot of reasons.
The 18 to 35.
It's a good example.
The 24 to 85 AFSG, mm-hmm. which is a nice lens on film, but it sort of was replaced by the 18 to 70
yeah.
DX lens. And
prices are plummeting.
You can get some of these lenses for half of what they originally sold for,
yeah.
if not less.
Right. And then there's also an article that you can find on there, and both of these are anchored threads that talks about how to check out a used lens that you've picked up, how to make sure that it's functioning correctly, and, you know, what to look for, how to test it, those kind of things. So hopefully those help.
Yeah, and there's another resource that you can use if you're looking to get you know, a ballpark price. Maybe you have a used item that you want to sell.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't know what the value of it is. I mean, obviously eBay is a good place to check out, see what other lenses are going for. Another one is keh.com. They're an online camera store, and they do a tremendous amount of business in used items. And I've purchased stuff from them before, and usually the grade that they give it is very conservative. Now, you will pay a little bit more than finding that really great eBay deal, but you can be pretty confident that it's going to be as described, if not better, and it will come with a warranty.
Right.
So whereas you might find an F5 for $600 on eBay, an excellent plus condition F5 right now at KEH is probably closer to $900. Now, does that mean you should go with eBay because it's cheaper? Well, it just really depends on you. You know that the item is there, and if you want to buy it, you don't have to bid on it. And for some people, that's and getting a warranty is, there's usually a 90-day warranty on all used items through those kinds of B&H, I think, also mm-hmm. has used. Adorama has some used. So just look around. But that's sort of the state of the
market. But you can save
right
an awful lot of money. You know, quite a bit of the stuff I have, I bought used, and, you know, sometimes you can get things in mint condition for less than half the
absolutely
price. It's
absolutely
amazing.
So that's great. Well, if you were with us last week for our episode, we talked about how we've been getting a lot of questions for sports photography, and
yeah.
we were going to shoot a live live podcast on location. Unfortunately, we went to the baseball game and picked up our press credentials, and there was a lot of rain happening last night at the game, so we didn't shoot it.
No, we drank beer instead.
We drank some beer, and we talked about Nikon,
yeah.
which is always our second most favorite hobby after podcasting.
So we're going to try again in a few weeks.
Yeah, we do have another date for another game that we're going to try to make. So hopefully our next podcast, a couple of weeks from now, we'll be able to bring you an on-location podcast from a baseball game.
Unless it rains again, and then we'll drink more beer probably.
Right, and maybe we can have a live on-location beer drinking podcast.
That would be possible.
We have the technology.
Yeah.
But
you had a... We've got a good thing to talk about on the sports side anyway.
That's right.
And it's what you did this last week.
What I did on my summer vacation.
Yeah.
I took some time off from work, and I went to the sports photography workshop that is run by Rich Clarkson and Associates. And I decided to do that because it happens to be here in Colorado Springs where I live, and I didn't have to rent a car or pay for a hotel room. The workshop itself was not entirely cheap, but it's very, it was an unbelievably good experience, especially for someone who's trying to get into the business of shooting sports professionally. breaking into a magazine or as a freelancer or as a staff photographer, whatever. It wasn't just about how to make your pictures better. It was about how to get into the business. And the staff was an absolute all-star cast of sports photographers and photography editors from major magazines. I'll give you an example of some of the people who we had a chance to meet with and review our portfolios. Charles Arbogast from the Associated Press was one of the people there. He was reviewing portfolios. He gave talks on how to improve our pictures. Rich Clarkson himself, the organizer, has been shooting the NCAA Final Four for over 50 years. He has a little experience in what makes a good photographer, you know, a good photograph. Matt Janella is an editor and photographer at Golf Digest and Golf World. He gave us his email address if we ever want to submit, you know, suggestions to cover an event. And he says, yeah, if you're at this workshop, let us know. And, you know, he'll try to read the emails. One of our favorite sports photographers, Dave Black, was one of the instructors. He led lighting workshops several days on how to use SB800s, how to do light painting. Plus, he critiqued images and looked at people's portfolios and gave a wonderful multimedia presentation of his work that was just to die for.
And if you recall, Dave was, I think, our first podcast interview.
Our second.
Was it the second?
But it was
one of the early ones. Yeah.
Back, if you go through the Behind the Lens series, and you can see my interview with Dave Black, and he's just an incredibly nice guy. Steve Fine from Sports Illustrated gave a talk. We had guys from newspapers. The Colorado Springs Gazette is our local paper. The photo editor was there. Bob Smith is a nature photographer. Mm-hmm. He comes to act as an instructor at the workshop. So Joey Terrell.
So really, I mean, good group.
The list is a laundry list of who's who in this business.
Yeah. Now, tell me a little bit about how it was organized. How long did it last? What kind of things did you do?
Well, the workshop itself ran from Sunday late afternoon through Friday evening. And it was pretty much an all-day affair. Every morning we'd start at 8, uploading our pictures. Apple was kind enough to donate, or loan, I should say, over 20 of the new MacBook Pro computers, each of which had Photoshop CS2 on it, Apple's Aperture, Photo Mechanic on it, amongst other things. So we could download our images. Each one of these computers had a Lexar card reader attached to it. And if you didn't have your own laptop, you could just go there, download whatever images, and use them as much as you needed. From about 9 to noon every day, there would be two or three workshop topics. Nikon Professional Services was a sponsor of this, and NPS was there not only to give talks about stuff, but also to loan equipment. We got seminars all morning on how to use light metering, how to use strobes, the manufacturers, some of the dealers were there. Roberts was one of our sponsors. They're actually there. If you needed to buy equipment, they had you taken care of. And you could do all this stuff. You could loan the gear. If you wanted to borrow sports strobes and light stands, you could go and do that. And these guys would show you how to use that equipment. Then the afternoons, we'd break for lunch. And in the afternoons, we'd have optional afternoon seminars, or you could go photograph. And each participant, every student, there were 60 of us, got a credential to shoot at the Olympic Training Center, which is here in Colorado Springs.
Kind of handy.
And you could go to other places, too. A lot of people went to the Garden of the Gods Park and shot rock climbing. But, for example, I took a studio strobe workshop on the first day, the first afternoon. We went into the swimming pool area where the Olympic swimming team was training. Shooting available light in there is very hard. Incredibly hard. You're at ISO 800. You've got mixed lighting. You've got fluorescent and daylight coming in through skylights. And you're lucky to get a shutter speed of 1/250th wide open at f2.8. It made it very tricky. But then we went over and we used strobes, and they had Pocket Wizard set up for the wireless control of these strobes. And it takes some skill, I learned. And then the next thing you know, you're shooting at 250th at f8. And you're freezing the motion, and you're getting wonderfully clean exposures, and it was just fantastic.
Now, were your ISO settings still pretty high, like 800?
No, at this point, we're shooting ISO 200 or 250.
So that makes a huge difference.
Oh, using it for now I know why the basketball arenas are strobed. Mm-hmm. It's because you can shoot at low ISO, you can shoot at F8, you get depth of field, you freeze the action. Now, the tough part about it was, if you're using a strobe, you have to be cognizant of where your strobes are going to reach to. Depending on how many of these strobes you have set up, you might not be lighting the entire arena. And that's not always a bad thing. We saw some nice shots where only half the arena was lit up. Maybe you're shooting a high school game, and maybe there's not a lot of people in the stands. Well, do you really want to strobe the stands to show the athletic department that there's no one at the game? Well, if you leave them dark, it's up to the imagination of the people looking at your image as to decide how many people were in the stands. So that you can use that lighting, and you can completely control the lighting. You don't have to rely on any of the lights in the gym or the arena that you're in when you strobe it. So that's really cool. But you have to learn where the reach of this thing, and you only get one shot. Typically, the strobes take about 2 to 3 seconds to recycle, depending on how much power you're putting out. So you have to pick
the point of that's the peak of action.
Right, you have to decide what you're doing.
Decisive moment kind of thing.
So we'd shoot every morning. We'd download those images, and they asked us to submit 3 for critique. And it was really, really great. I mean, seeing not just what getting feedback on your own shots. And believe me, these editors, they weren't afraid to say something was blah. You know, if it was crappy, they said it. But most of the time, they were giving positive feedback. Well, this was a good attempt. You tried to do this, and we applaud that you tried to do this new technique. We know you're just learning it for the first time. If you go back and do it again, maybe you should take this or that into consideration. One of the things I tried to do, for example, was use slower shutter speeds in pan. You know, that's hard. But they would applaud a good attempt if you had one. The first day, there was a lot of okay images, and there was a lot of sort of marginal images, or some even bad images. By the last day, you could see that there was only 3 or 4 images in there that weren't great. And even those, you could tell, well, they were trying this, and they were pretty close to capturing that moment the way they wanted. They just didn't quite nail it. And my photography improved tremendously just in that 1 week by getting that continuous feedback.
Right. What do you think was the most important thing that you learned?
Well, a couple of things. If you're shooting for an editor and you want your picture to be chosen, obviously the things that go without saying is get your exposure and focus correct. You know, it's they can tell a badly exposed shot. Now, if you're shooting in JPEG, that can be tricky. But if you shoot in RAW, you have a little bit of latitude to correct some of this stuff. Most editors will not ask for the RAW file, with the exception of Sports Illustrated. But the most important thing was to look. They said a few things that were really important. One was, you're responsible for all 4 corners of the frame, whether there's something in it or not. And that means clean backgrounds. Clean backgrounds is probably the one thing that they harped on more than anything else. Or large out-of-focus objects in the foreground. They're very distracting. Sometimes it can work. Like if you're behind home plate and you've got the batter out of focus and you got, you know, and it's all there. But if there's signage in the background, advertising, you know, something that makes, even if it's not in your control, if you can try to control it and get the similar shot with a clean background, that one will always win. You know, that's the one that they are looking for. Sometimes these editors are going to want to have a loose composition. They want to put text over it. But if you've got a real distracting, cluttered background, a hot spot, a highlight somewhere that's blown out in the background, you know, unless it's a real spectacular image that's unique, you know, Tiger Woods bungee jumping or something, chances are they'll go with some other image. So that was really the important, you know, it's not just the composition, but it's paying attention to those other elements. And I'll tell you, that's really hard to do.
Yeah.
When you're following the action, basketball is a great example of that. You have to tell yourself to slow down and just say, I'm going to shoot this in this way. Now, the best part about this whole thing was you got to play with Nikon equipment. Mm-hmm. If you wanted a D2H, I should say a D2HS, they had them. You want a D2X, they had them. You want a D200, they had those. You want a lens? Great. I shot the 200 F2. Now, there's a piece of glass that I'm probably not going to buy anytime soon, but I went and shot a basketball game with that because I knew it was going to be an available light situation. I had my 70 to 200 2.8, but I wanted that extra stop. But when you're shooting at 200 millimeters, you're not going to shoot under the basket. I found myself shooting from the opposite baseline, the action at the other end of the court. So you have to decide what lens you're using and think about pre-visualizing. That concept comes mm-hmm. back. But, you know, if you can get into the gym or wherever you're going first to take a look at where you might want to be, do it. Change your angle. You don't always have to shoot from floor level. Shoot from the stands.
Now, you learned some good tips on autofocus, right?
Oh,
absolutely. You were mentioning those when we were drinking beer.
Absolutely. We talk a lot about autofocus and getting the best performance, and we had a brief presentation by the NPS representative who came down from Denver, and this guy knows everything, anything and everything about Nikon and the technology, and he was talking about autofocus, how it works, etc. Now, I know we've talked about these autofocus modes before. The fastest autofocus mode is single area autofocus point, and it kind of makes sense. Let me step back for a second and just sort of describe what the way he told it to us. The recommendation for shooting sports was to set up your camera, and this would work for something like a D200 or a D2 series camera, and a D1 series camera too, where you have the AF on button on the back of the camera. The recommendation was to use, sort of obviously, continuous servo autofocus, which is the switch on the front of the camera.
Right.
You put in a continuous. And then you use release priority. So you want the camera to fire regardless if it thinks if something's in focus or not. And I'll explain why you do that in a minute. And then you're going to decouple the autofocus from the shutter release button and just use the AF on button. It takes some practice. But the idea is you can effectively use this technique just like you would use single servo autofocus. You compose, you hit the AF button, you release the AF button, and now focus is locked on that plane wherever it was. And now when you hit the shutter button, it's not going to try to refocus. Because you're in release priority, it will take the picture regardless if your subject is on the autofocus bracket or not. Again, it takes some practice, but it's useful. If you're going to use single servo autofocus, single area autofocus, you have to keep that focus point on your subject. But the camera will track amazingly fast because it's disregarding the data from all of those other 10 autofocus points.
Mm-hmm.
The second fastest autofocus mode to use is the group dynamic autofocus. And this also follows with how much data does the camera have to process and evaluate to find the sharp image. In group dynamic, you can use up to five of the, depending on the pattern you select, you can use five sensors. It only looks at what's in those five sensors.
And you can move that area around.
And you can move that area around.
You could have it on the right, on the left, the top, the bottom, the center.
Yeah, and you can change the patterns around in some of the custom settings.
Right.
But it disregards the sensors that aren't in the pattern. That means it has less data to process. It can keep up faster. Now, the slowest autofocus modes to use are going to be the closest focus priority mode, where it just looks at all 11 sensors all the time and just tries to find the closest one.
And that's because it's having to go through and determine, you know,
yes,
what is the closest focus distance.
I mean, and
that
still
all
works.
Sensors.
But that's not going to be your best bet for tracking a highly fast-moving subject.
Yeah.
The second slowest one to use is single area dynamic, not group dynamic, because while you set the initial autofocus point, the camera has to still evaluate the focus data stream coming in from all of those other 10 sensors.
To determine if the subject's moving around
right.
and things
now,
like that.
Now, what I didn't know about this and what I learned from having lunch with the Nikon reps is that we talked about this, is that more of these, and I'll use a dangerous word here, but the B word, the back focus
Uh-oh.
Issues.
Uh-oh.
But he says more of these examples of my camera is back focusing are not caused by the camera back focusing at all, but are instead caused. They said the first question he would ask is, what focus mode were you? And almost invariably, it was single area dynamic autofocus. What was happening was that a moving subject coming, say, towards the camera, it was either picking the wrong, it would find a higher contrast target in one of the other sensor areas from one of the other autofocus streams. And when it did, it might lock on a little bit. There might be a lag, especially if the subject was coming towards you. So it would lock on to the subject where it was a split second ago. and not quite keep up. I mean, mind you, the lock-on and the autofocus and the D2 series cameras is incredibly fast, but you have to put it in the right mode to really take advantage of that.
I think one of the things that this is reinforcing is the fact that photography is a craft, and it takes a long time to learn. You're going to keep learning it for the rest of your life, most likely. And that even includes a little technical things like this stuff. There's no such thing as just simply putting a camera on some canned settings, pointing it at a subject, and getting a Sports Illustrated cover.
No, you have to know what you're doing.
Getting the cover to National Geographic. It takes a lot of knowledge. Knowledge of light, your tools, composition. And if you're trying to sell stuff, what does sell? What's the market like?
Right. And what I learned.
It may not be what you enjoy doing. It may be something else.
You know, what I learned as a beginner, I mean, I'm a total newbie when it comes to sports photography. So compared to the, you know, when it came to shooting, I shot a baseball game, I shot basketball, these fast moving things. Well, being able to slow the game down in your brain, knowing your camera so that you can start focusing on composition and the backgrounds takes a lot of practice. I can do birds, no problem, and landscapes, no problem. But sports, I was just happy to have a, you know, subject in focus, okay?
Yeah.
You know, and so you could tell from those pictures that I was still learning. I was a total beginner, even though I knew how to use my camera.
They look good to me, though. I think I would have been in a lot worse shape because I'm definitely not an action photographer.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting when you hear interviews with athletes where they talk about making the move from college sports to professional sports, especially with American football. You know, they move from what's the biggest change between the pro game and the college game? Well, they say, well, the speed of the pro game is so much faster. And, you know, for the quarterback to sit there, I have to be good enough so that the game slows down. I think you could say the same about sports photography. When the game is slowing down and you're able to just get in that zone where you're focusing on the players and you're composing and you're not trying to, you're not going to get every shot.
Well, I think, you know, one thing that this brings up is the idea of, for a successful photo, you have to figure out first, what's the photo going to be of? What's the subject? Mm-hmm. And it's not everything that's out there. That doesn't work for landscapes, it doesn't work for wildlife, and it sounds like it doesn't work for sports either.
No, it just depends on what you want to do.
Think through, what is the subject? What's important about it? What do I like about it? What's interesting about it? And make that the subject of the photo, as opposed to just, hey, I was there. Here's a picture with everything that was there in the frame.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, some things that I learned from the, you know, one of the wonderful things about the critique session is that they just put pictures up. And some of us were shooting Nikon and some people were shooting other brands. And never once did someone say, it looks like you used a Nikon and you should have used a Canon or vice versa to take this picture. It was just, that's a nice image, or that image works because of this, or this image doesn't work because of that. Noise was never an issue.
Yeah.
You know, these things that people harp on, these, you know, people who scrutinize everything under a magnifying glass, that's not what the editors are looking for. Mm. Do they want it in focus? Of course they do. They want it sharp. But it didn't matter that, you know, I shot up to ISO 800 on my D2X, and, you know, just for fun, I printed some out at 8.5 by 11 inch size. They're fine.
Yeah.
They're totally fine.
I think we may have talked about this one time before, but for quite a while there, I was judging some of our monthly photo contests on our site. And I'll tell you, there was pretty much no correlation whatsoever between the price of the camera or the technology of the camera and who won. It just really didn't matter. Mm-hmm. It was composition, it was original ideas, it was effective use of color or black and white. It was those things.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, I mean, with the newer cameras, with like the Cam 2000 autofocus, you're going to have an advantage because you can move the focus point to a better composition.
But don't dismiss the other stuff.
But, you know, this idea of being able to, you know, use the AF on button, practice with that, and then recompose. It was very powerful. Now, the other thing we did a little bit of work with was doing sports portraiture. And, you know, I played around for the first time with the SB800s wirelessly, and that was really cool too.
Yeah.
And again, the same comments. Watch your background. Some people went and shot up at Garden of the Gods, which is the city park here at Colorado Springs. Very, very, very scenic. You know, really
large sandstone rock formations.
Yeah, red rock formations, yeah, and stuff like that. And they had a picture of a guy. It was a vertical shot. He was a cyclist. He was holding his bike over his shoulder. You know, Olympic cyclist. He was in uniform. It looked really great. But they said, you know, there's those wonderful rock formations in the background, and they're through the spokes of the bicycle. And if you just got a slightly different perspective, either a little higher or lower, and you get those, you know. So, again, you're responsible for every corner of that frame to make sure that it's interesting. Mm-hmm. And that takes some practice. It takes some work. But it was very refreshing. I can't recommend this workshop highly enough, especially if we had people a guy came all the way from Singapore to attend this workshop because he Wow. heard it was the best. We had a woman there from Australia and other places. I mean, so this is a pretty big name. You'll meet the pretty big names. You can sign up and have these people. You can sit down with the photographer. How many times can you sit down with the managing editor from Sports Illustrated and have him look at your portfolio in person? These are people who you never get even 30 seconds of their time if you went right. and visited them in their office and wherever that might be, you know? So absolutely great. Can't recommend it enough. Now, the last thing that I did at the workshop was I got to interview Rich Clarkson for about a half an hour for an Iconians podcast. So you want to check that out real soon here. And he talked about his experiences shooting Final Four basketball games. He was an editor at National Geographic. I mean, the guy's done everything and he knew yeah. everybody. So very, very interesting.
Yeah, sounds like a great experience.
It was a great experience. The website is sportsphotographyworkshop.com. Like I said, they hold it every year here in Colorado Springs. You'll need to start saving up now, because the way it works is you'll need to pay for a hotel room and you'll need your own transportation. Everybody was free to do whatever they wanted. And so you didn't have to go anywhere, or you would, you know, drive around town. So mm-hmm. things being spread out here, you'll need to budget in a car.
Yeah.
So, but it was a great, great experience, and I'm going to think about going again next year.
I might join you.
That was definitely fun.
I think that does it for our topics.
Yeah.
And let's see, next episode, well, potentially some more.
We hope
sports
to have that
stuff.
On-location baseball yeah. game shoot, and we're going to really push for that one.
Yeah.
Hopefully the thunderstorms won't be happening.
Yeah, we've still got some RAW converter topics coming up.
Yeah.
We've still got to do the Adobe RAW converter.
And we got a good suggestion to talk about the ITTL system.
Yeah.
I think we're going to try to work that in too.
Yeah, that'll be soon. Very soon.
So that's what we've got for you today. Thanks again for joining us.
Yep. And we'll talk to you soon.
Yep. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.